So check this out. So I didn't read any of the questions because I kind of, because then I'd be thinking about it and trying to come up with like the perfect answer. I kind of like just going on the fly. And like,
yeah.
We knew you wouldn't, and so we'll just screw you live. Yeah. So good.
They're really hard. They're mean too.
Oh, good. I like the mean ones. Yeah.
Everybody on the lawn gonna sing it with me. I love you guys. It's called Hey There, Delilah.
Welcome to Project Rework, where we help you rethink the way you think about work. In the background, you are hearing Tom Higginson of the Plain White Tees. We've got him on the show, and in this episode, we talk about the creative process, positivity through setbacks, and hear behind-the-scenes stories from his life on tour. A quick announcement, you've all been seeing posts from companies and CEOs about their support of Black Lives Matter, about fixing racial inequalities. If you're like us, you're probably asking yourself, is this a bunch of BS for good publicity, or will our biggest companies actually be part of real change? So for the next few weeks, we're going to be digging deeper into this. We've got some interviews lined up in which we'll be talking to experts and researchers about race and racial bias in the workplace. So hit the subscribe button on your podcast app so you don't miss a thing.
Hey there, Delilah, I know at times you're getting hard. Just believe me, girl, someday I'll pay the bills with this guitar. We'll have a good.
So, Tom Higginson, we've got the singer, guitarist, frontman of Plain White Tees with us. Thank you. Excited to talk to you. We're going to start off, fun question. Think back, what is the first album you fell in love with?
Ooh, okay. I got two answers for this. When I was like first, like maybe 9 years old, I remember watching The Monkees on TV, like probably Nickelodeon or something back then. And that was like the first group where I was like begging my mom to like go buy the cassette tape. I'm like, I need to have this music. I love this band, you know? So The Monkees were definitely my first like fanboy experience where I was like, this is so awesome. I love music. I love this band. And then let's cut to me being 15 years old. Just starting to write songs and stuff on my own, learning how to play guitar and stuff. And Alanis Morissette comes out with Jagged Little Pill. Mm-hmm. And that album to me just completely, I mean, it struck a chord, of course, but it, you know, along with 47 million other people, right? But it just hit me on this level of like, man, like that's the album that made me want to write songs for the rest of my life, like want to do it for a living. Like before that, all other music was like, it was awesome and I loved music, but that album just hit me a little bit deeper than anything else. And that made me want to write songs and do it.
And you have been doing it. This has been your career musician since then. So with any career, anything that you're doing day in and day out, there's things you like and don't like. So you've got songwriting, recording, live shows, connecting with fans, managing a business, working with record labels. What were the components of the career of being a professional musician that came naturally to you, and which ones were a struggle to get passionate about or had a steeper learning curve?
Yeah. So, you know, I'm kind of like an eternal optimist. I don't really think about anything too negative or any obstacles. I'm just kind of like, okay, I see the light, I'm going to go, you know? So it's like at 17, we started this band and I just started writing songs and it was like, cool. We saw, you know, ever since the band started, there was a very constant, like very slow, mind you, but constant growth. You know, it's like we set a goal to play at the Metro in Chicago, which was our favorite venue that holds about 1,000 people. And within a year of being a band, we got our first show at the Metro. And, you know, so it's like little steps like that. And then, you know, a couple years later, we were selling out shows at the Metro. And then we started going to play in, you know, colleges, Champaign, Illinois, and Milwaukee, and things like, you know, around Chicago. So it was just a very steady, constant growth. And I mean, there was a million things along the way that probably told us, like, yo, stop, you can't do this. You know, our equipment got stolen one time, all of our gear when we were in California on tour, one of our first tours ever. And I mean, that was like devastating to us. We had no money to replace it. We, you know, we're in the middle of a tour. We had to figure out how to borrow the other band's gear.
Is that what you guys did?
Yeah, we literally used, you know, the other bands were cool.
Oh, man, right on.
Yeah, we just finished the tour out using borrowed stuff. And then luckily, you know, my grandparents bought me. Yeah, the guitar that I wrote Hey There Delilah on got stolen. So total bummer.
Oh my God. I wonder if I'm assuming the person who stole it. No, I wonder if they knew it.
Probably just some like LA thugs that were like right away or something. I don't know.
I was hoping there was a better story, at least for the thief.
Yeah, I doubt it. I don't know. But yeah, so there was a lot of moments like that, where, you know, people quitting the band and stuff, and, you know, a lot of moments where it would have been very easy to say like, okay, like this just isn't in the cards for us. So, you know, but I never once thought that. It was just like, oh, well, our gear got stolen. I guess we got to figure out how to get some new gear. You know, it's just go, go, go. And then, like you said, through the year, that was just all on us, you know, us with basically a booking agent and a small, very small independent label at the time that we were on. And of course, then you get, you know, as we got more and more popular, then there was major labels that you have to deal with. And it was like, you know, a little bit of that, like not selling your soul, but it was like, oh man, like they're taking this and this and these royalties. And I don't know. But at the same time, it's like, but that's what could get us to
right.
this level and all, you know, so it's a very weird thing. But luckily I will say that the label that we were on Hollywood Records, which was owned by Disney. And we had a really great A&R guy, and that's like the guy that signs the band, finds the talent, signs the bands, and then works directly with them, making albums and helping choose the right songs and things like that. And I loved our A&R guy, so we had a very good relationship, especially for the first few albums on the major label. And so there wasn't really, again, maybe it's just my blinders, but there wasn't really that much, that much drama or that much. Many obstacles.
I think you're not giving yourself enough credit, though. I mean, because you're saying you're an eternal optimist, but I mean, what you just described like requires a lot of perseverance, right? You know, I mean, I think you're calling it blinders, but I wonder how much resilience and grit you actually showed by continuing. I mean, because that is actually what resilience and grit is. I mean, it's actually like the posture you take in the midst of like turmoil, right? So you got something that happens and then yet you're choosing not to like succumb to that feeling and get all pessimistic, right? And pissed off and the world's against me. And you're still choosing, right, to have a specific perspective on life, right? And so it sounds you had plenty of chances, you know, to do that. I wonder how many bands actually, you know, potentially were in your situation and actually did that, right? And unfortunately, maybe they inhibited themselves. So yeah, I just want to give you some credit. I mean, I think, you know, you're talking about perspective that, you know, kind of teaching people perspective in the midst of turmoil, right? Have positive perspective.
Yeah. Well, thanks. Thanks for giving me that credit. I don't know.
That's what I'm here for.
For me, I just, again, the way from my angle, it was just like I didn't care.
Right,
it was like, man, yeah. I know I want to get to this level. I know I just love writing songs and love playing music. So it's like, I'm not going to let any of this crap bother me.
Cool. You know? Cool.
And you mentioned that it was sort of a steady growth of achieving sort of incremental goals of filling out a show, getting to a next goal. Were there any breakout moments where you maybe had a goal and then something happened with a song or a performance where you shot past that goal to a level of popularity or appreciation among fans that you were not expecting?
So there was one, like we really had to claw, you know, claw our way through every goal and everything that we wanted to achieve. But there was one lightning in a bottle, you know, one in a million moment, like our big break moment. I would consider that we went to, that we were friends with the Fall Out Boy guys when they were kind of coming up because they were from Chicago here. And Pete, the bass player, had just bought a house in the Hollywood Hills because they blew up like right before we were kind of coming up. And he invited us to a party. And this is kind of a, I'll try to make a long story short here. He invited us to like his housewarming party because we were in LA and we had just finished our album. And we had a listening party at the label in LA that day. And so we got, it was literally the first day we were able to hold a copy of our album that we had recorded. And then awesome. Pete has this party, invites us to it. So we all go there along with our A&R guy I was talking about from the label. And as soon as we walk in, the A&R guy is like, hey, that's Lisa Warden from K-Rock. And K-Rock is the alternative radio station in Los Angeles. And at that point, especially, one of the most influential radio stations in the country. And so me being a little bit buzzed off a few glasses of wine that we had celebrating our, you know, our release or our mastering party, whatever. And the album, by the way, wasn't coming out for 3 months until, you know, at that point. And so I went right up to this, you know, he said, that's Lisa Warden from K-Rock. And so I went right up to her and was like, hey, you work at K-Rock. I'm Tom from Plain White Tees. And she's like, oh, Plain White Tees. Yeah, I've heard of you guys. And I'm like, we just mastered our album. You got to come listen to the first single. And so we dragged her out of the party into our A&R guy's car, you know, and parked on this, practically upside down on this Hollywood Hills street, really weird, awkward angle. And so we're in there and he pushes play on a song called Hate, which was our first single we were going to radio with. And basically she said, you got to let me have this. And the next morning she played it on the radio.
That's amazing.
It was like, yeah, that's the kind of thing.
How did that, did you hear it? Did you hear it the next morning?
No, I woke up super hungover because I'm not a big drinker.
Because you had more than a couple glasses of wine.
So I woke up just miserable to a text from the A&R guy saying, on K-Rock, call me. And so I think I literally like stumbled into like a bathroom, probably threw up, and then called our A&R guy. And he's like, dude, you were on the radio. We got to talk. We got to figure out a campaign for this song, do a video, blah, 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 you know? Wow. But yeah, that was the moment where it was like, we went from, like I said, really clawing and fighting for everything and the slow growth. And it was like the chances of her being there, liking it, putting her neck out, you know, going against any program director or any higher up to just say, I love this. I'm going to play it, you know?
And right on.
Yeah. Really right cool. On. And then one more moment. I'm sorry. I know.
Oh no, don't apologize. That was a good story.
We were playing the Milwaukee Summerfest. I don't know if you guys know what that is, but it's like a big, it's kind of like Lollapalooza or like Coachella.
Right.
And it's like been going on in Milwaukee for like years, like literally like 50 years or something, tradition. And we've played there before, you know, playing on some smaller stages, opening up for other big bands and stuff. And this was like the summer, like going into like probably end of June, the year that Hey There Delilah was a big hit for us. So at this point, the song was just starting to kind of hit radio and climbing up the charts. And we were playing Milwaukee Summerfest, which we'd done before. And we were headlining the stage or playing last on this stage, whatever stage we were at. And so we were just kind of backstage the whole day, you know, not really paying attention to the other bands playing. We're just kind of doing our thing. We probably had some family, you know, around and stuff. And so it was time to hit the stage. And we literally walked out on stage to like a crowd of 10,000 people. And we had this moment where it was almost like a double take where we all kind of like looked at each other like what is this? Like, who, I thought we were last, who's going on next? You know, like, who are these people here to see? And then we realized like, wow, no, that's like the power of having like a song on the radio, like a hit song. So yeah, that was one of those moments where you had to like pinch yourself, like, wow, this is real right now. It's crazy.
Oh, that must've been awesome.
It was, yeah.
That's amazing. It's hard to bring such an optimistic, positive person from a high to a low, but I'm curious.
That's what we're here for as well.
So, okay, when I think about musicians, comedians, you're getting on stage in front of people, there's a huge vulnerability and risk there, and I imagine to get good at it, there's got to be some failure moments. Did you ever bomb in front of people, in front of an audience, and how do you muster up the strength to get back on stage after something like that?
So some of our very first tours that we ever did, we like booked ourselves, and it was literally like we played to zero people with the bartender, like literally an empty room with one bartender watching.
But you still did the show?
I mean, we kind of had to. We're like, well, okay, we're here. We set up, you know, we dragged our gear in, we set it up. And there was some other time, there was one other time I remember really bad. We were opening up for like a bigger band at the House of Blues in Chicago.
Yeah.
And it was like first, you know, there was a, they had a curtain too. So it's like curtain opens. And I think it was our first time ever playing at the House of Blues. Big deal for us. And curtain opens, the lights come up, sold out crowd. And we like our drummer, something happened where we started the song like wrong. Like he started earlier and we're all behind him. And we're all kind of like looked at each other, like panic, like what the hell just happened? What's going on? And it was really awkward for a second. And then it was like, okay, like let's do it again. And then he started it and the set was fine after that. But that was, I mean, that's probably not bombing, but that was one of those moments where it was like,
yeah, your heart drops. Yeah.
Oh my God. And you know, there's been definitely moments like we were on Warped Tour, which is like a summer punk rock traveling.
In there.
Oh my God. I mean, it's a nightmare for bands. It's amazing for bands, but the work and the non-sleeping and the dirtiness and the dragging your gear all over, it's a really, really rough tour. And I've definitely like fallen on stage. That's really embarrassing. You know, you trip over somebody's guitar cord or you just, you know, whatever, slip because it's so dusty or sweaty or whatever. And that's pretty damn embarrassing. Forgetting words is always like, you feel like I have got one job up here and I can't even do it. I can't even remember the words that I wrote to my own song, you know? So yeah, there's been some moments like that, but I don't know. You just got to kind of shake it off. And, you know, it's like, you got to remember when I would go to a show and if a moment like that happened, I'd be like, oh, that was so cool. I saw the guy fall or I saw, you know, like I saw him forget like the lyrics. And, you know, it's like, as a fan, you kind of enjoy those moments because they're unique to a show or, you know, they don't happen all the time. So that's just, I try to remind myself that like, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
People like that stuff.
Yeah, it's a good perspective shift. So let's get into creative process. So Malcolm Gladwell had a really interesting episode of his podcast a couple years ago, I think, where he was talking about the song Hallelujah by Leonard Cohen. Cohen spent 5 years or so writing the song, but it wasn't for decades later until Jeff Buckley's version that it became a hit and really like the heart of the song, I think, was discovered. There's a story of Leonard Cohen and Bob Dylan having a conversation and Dylan says, oh, that song Hallelujah is pretty good. How long did it take you to write? Leonard Cohen sort of lied and minimized that up 2 years down from five. And then Cohen asked Dylan, how long did it take you to write I and I? And Dylan said 15 minutes. And the point of this was that there's an idea that there's different types of creative genius. One is sort of that slow brooding, growing, sort of chiseling away at the rock till you discover what's underneath it. And the other is spark of inspiration. It comes to you and just comes pouring out. Can you give us a view into what that process is like for you and maybe where you've fallen on that scale or if you bounce between both? How does a song come out of you?
So definitely, I would say currently, it's almost like it's almost a double-edged sword that we have these phones in our pockets that can, you know, I can instantly record a voice memo of an idea that I have, like as I'm coming up with it, because a lot of times, even though that's so convenient, right, for ideas and for creativity, a lot of times I'll mess around with this idea. Oh, this is cool. Voice memo it. And then once I voice memo it, I don't feel the urgency to continue on with it. Mm. It's like, okay, cool. I've got the idea down. Like I can come back to that later. And if I still think it's good, then I'll try to develop it or something. And a lot of times, like you said, it's that instant spark of creativity that you know, drives you to create a song. Like back, let's say 10 years ago, 15 years ago, before you had that capability, you know, you'd kind of have to sit a little bit more and spend a little bit more time with an idea to develop it, or just play it enough that, okay, like I used to think, okay, if I can remember this, you know, 5 hours from now after I go out or do something and come back home, and if I still remember it, then that's how I know it's good, you know? So yeah. I wouldn't record anything at all. So yeah, it's kind of difficult now to develop that initial spark and go with it. But I definitely try to sometimes. But to answer your question, in the past and with some of our hit songs, like a song 1, 2, 3, 4, which was a big hit for us, I literally was sandwiched in the back of a van with all the guys. We had all our luggage on our laps, going to some show we'd just flown in to play. And I was looking out the window, you know, pressed up against the window. And I'm thinking about like John Lennon and Paul McCartney writing, "I Want to Hold Your Hand," sitting at a piano together, and just trying to come up with a very simple just idea. And I came up with the idea of doing like 1, 2, 3, 4 in the sentences like that. We were on our way to our show. So I, again, didn't really have anything to write it down. Didn't have time to develop it. But then later that night we were at our hotel, and I was sharing a room with our guitar player, and he like went to sleep right after we got done with our show. And so I had to like go into the bathroom and just kind of like, you know, flush out this song with my guitar playing really quiet, you know. And I actually thought that when I was writing it in the car, that it would be an up-tempo, you know, there's only one thing to do, like a fun, like more punk rock kind of thing. But because I had to sit quietly in the bathroom with this guy sleeping over there, I kind of wrote it and it ended up being this quiet thing. And of course, after the success of Delilah, it was like, well, we should probably just keep it nice and quiet like this, you know, and kind of keep it in the same vein as Delilah. And so, yeah, I ended up writing that song within half hour sitting in the bathroom there.
So the constraint, yeah. So the constraint of the bathroom, like, caused you to be more innovative. That's awesome.
But yeah, so for awesome. Delilah, though, more along the Leonard Cohen lines, Delilah. So the first, Delilah was this real girl, and long story short, she was from Chicago and then went to school in New York. And I had just met her right before she left for school, and we joked around that I had written a song about her, whatever. So she was kept egging me on, like, "Hey, where's my song? When do I get to hear my song?" And so then I started writing the song, and literally the first verse, I didn't even think about it. It was just, "What's it like in New York City? Tonight you look so pretty, Times Square," all that stuff. And then the same thing with, like, you know, "Don't worry about the distance, I'm right there if you get lonely," "Song Another Listen." And then it was like, after that, like, I literally wrote that. It was the first words that just came out of my mouth, "Just the way you hear them." And then it was like, oh no, like, this is really good. And like, that's all I know about this girl. I've pretty much exhausted everything, you know, all the details right there in that first verse. So I took my time with that one, and I spent about 6 or 7 months just kind of coming back to it when I had the time, or, you know, taking a shower, thinking about it or whatever. And I kind of had to write the rest of the song a little bit more, being a little bit more creative and thinking about, like, if I did have this long distance relationship with somebody, what would I want to say? I'll pay the bills with this guitar, you know, planes and trains and cars and all that stuff kind of. I had to work a little bit harder to craft the rest of it, whereas the beginning of it came so easily. So
yeah,
it's definitely, to answer your question, there's no right or wrong way. Yeah. You know, it hits you in all different angles, and you just got to kind of, you know. I think one thing though, I will say, I read this book called "The War of Art," and it was like it kind of talked about, you know, the mythology of art in general, you know, like this divine hand comes and just grabs you and you write this masterpiece or something, you know? And the point of the book is that's not really the case. It's more about like like checking in every day and just picking up the guitar every day. And just some days you got it, some days you don't.
Right.
But without that constant attempt and that, you know, just keeping your mind and your muscle, you know, working and, you know, toned up and on your craft, you know, that's, it's, you're not just going to write your masterpiece out of nowhere, right. You know?
Right. And even if it comes out very quickly, it was really, you know, the 2 decades of practicing every day.
That's right.
Allowed it to flow out of you so naturally.
Right. The 10,000 hours or whatever they say. Right?
Yeah. I think a lot of people take that grind away from creativity, I guess, because maybe it takes away the romanticism, right, of creativity away. Right. But in the end, you know, it really doesn't. I mean, I think you're kind of alluding to something, right? You know, just being consistent, maybe entering into a space at a consistent amount of time. Right. And if you do that, you're giving yourself the capacity, right, for creativity. So, No, that's awesome. Giving us kind of some insight into how you do it.
And most days, by the way, I totally suck. You know, most days you sit there and it's like, God, this is the worst crap I've ever heard.
Oh, I don't have any inspiration. I empathize. You
know? Yeah. But you do that, you do it 100 times and you're going to get a few good ones. Whereas right. You do it 5 times.
It's a statistics game. That's right.
Yeah, exactly.
So we just, with Project Rework, just released an article about appreciation in the workplace and how important it is to give direct appreciation to the people that you're working with. Like, hey, I really like that you did this. It was so thoughtful. And that how that direct affirmation helps build camaraderie. And with workplace rhetoric, it's all about positivity, building a team, collaboration, all those, like, you know, catchphrasy things. But there's some really interesting research done by some Harvard researchers that suggests that creativity often can come out more through negative experiences rather than through positivity. And one of the things that they were seeing was that actually after a potentially conflictual interaction with someone or a toxic conversation, that angst that causes you can actually be what breeds better ideas, which is really antithetical when you think about the workplace. But I imagine when you're in a creative industry, you know, you don't have workplace culture you have to follow. And I'm curious, in your experience, you seem like a very positive, optimistic person, as you've said. Is it happy moments, painful moments, positive relationships, negative relationships that can breed that desire to create, or a whole mix of it?
Okay. Well, when things are good, you don't necessarily think, oh my God, I need to write a song right now. You know, it is usually like, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening, or I've got to get something off my chest, or, you know, something that inspires you to turn to the guitar is usually not necessarily, you know, a content, fine, happy moment, you know, like a lot of the song, like a lot of love songs are probably written in, at least in my experience, for someone that you do not have, you know, it's like, man, I want this person. I want their attention. I want their, you know, their affection. So I need to do this, you know, and then once you have the person, it's not necessarily like, oh, I don't need to write your song anymore because I already got you. You know, it's kind of a weird thing. Like in Delilah, her case, for example, she actually had a boyfriend when I met her. And so that almost gave me, because I knew, like, okay, this girl is kind of off limits, that kind of gave me the security blanket to write this beautiful song, knowing that, you know, it's probably nothing's going to happen. And she's got this boyfriend. So like you said, it's kind of like that toxicness. I don't know if that's necessarily toxic, but, you know, kind of the defiance of like, oh, you got a boyfriend, huh? Well, then I can do this. Whereas if it was some girl that was like really in love with me and I wrote that song, it's almost like I wouldn't write that song because then it would, she'd fall even more in love with, I don't know. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, no.
Like the juxtaposition, I think, the, you know, what do they call it? The ebb and
flow.
Is it? yeah, whatever it is. I think that definitely, you know, you always are going, want to go a little bit against some kind of grain in a weird way.
Have you, and I guess another way to ask it, have you written anything maybe at a time where things were a bit despondent or more sadness was kind of more pervasive in your life at the time, and then you wrote something kind of from that experience? Yeah, I'm interested to know that.
Well, I mean, so in 1999, and the band had just started, we started in 97, and in 99, I got in a really bad car accident and almost like pretty much woke up in the hospital the next day with a broken back. A few of my organs were damaged, but nothing was to the point where I had to have surgery. It was all, you know, kind of able to heal itself. But I had to kind of learn how to walk again. I had to wear a back brace for like 3 months and stuff like that. And that was the moment for me where it was like, okay, I'd been writing songs and being in the band at that point. But that was like, man, like that, this is crazy. Like I should be dead. Like maybe I should take this songwriting and put a little bit more of my own story or my own, you know, heart, I guess, into these songs. And I wrote this one song called I-88 because I was on Interstate 88 at the time of my accident. It was, song was kind of about my accident and like getting through it. And there was a batch of songs I wrote right at that time that were very personal, like more than I'd ever done before. It was just being more vulnerable and putting myself out there more. And that was one of the first kind of jumps in like the, you know, the growth of the band.
Right.
It was like, it went from like, oh, this cool local band where friends were coming out and stuff to like, oh, wait, people are really responding to these songs, you know?
Yeah, that's really good. And I think the basis for our question was like what Alex said, you know, there's a lot of literature. I took a class, like I'm doing my MBA right now, I took a class called Fostering Creativity, and it's almost all centered around like positivity, which is fine. That's cool. But then there's a lot of evidence, right? Tons of evidence on like the darker side of creativity. And it's just like, you know, well, that's reflective of the human experience, right? I mean, we, you know, all of us go through like various experiences, and especially right now, I mean, there's tons of people, you know, just being laid off, you know, out of work, kind of their identities have been changed, right? Because a lot of them found their identity in their vocation and their careers. And so their lives have been upended. So it's more on that side of things, right? Can people still engage in creativity, right? In the midst of, you know, what's going on, right? And kind of all the uncertainty and angst that they're feeling right now. So even though, what you're talking about is songwriting. I mean, I think in whatever people's profession or vocation is, they can still find, they can find themselves engaging in creativity, right? As they try to look at, okay, how are they going to pivot in their career now that this has happened to them?
Yeah, totally. We're seeing that a lot now. So many people who have lost their jobs or their hours are cut. A lot of people are trying to figure out, how do I start an online store? How do I turn my side hustle into my main hustle? So curious to hear about some of the pivots you must be making right now. I mean, the band can't be on tour. You can't go perform live places. Where has that taken your music making, music playing, or just the platform you have in a different direction during the pandemic?
Yeah. Well, luckily, this couch right here behind me with these two guitars, this is where I do a lot of my writing. So I'm doing a lot of that sitting right here and just trying to, like you guys said, trying to tap into that. I wouldn't call it necessarily negativity, but yeah, this uncertainty of these times, and try to, you know, be inspired by it. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of songs that come out of this. How I miss you, and you know, connectivity and things like that. So yeah, I've just been kind of trying to stay positive and optimistic, and look at this as a time to be creative and write more. Obviously get to be with my son and be that role I take very seriously as a father, as a, you know, a job or whatever. You know, I'm able to really focus in on that, and sometimes I don't do the best job when we're doing math and he's not focusing. I get a little aggravated, but you know, it's like, this is still life. And I think that's what you're saying. It's like, you just got to find your own way, because it's not like life is just on pause right now and then all of a sudden it's just going to go back to normal. It's right. Like, this is still life happening right now. Right. So it's like, okay, what am I going to do with today that's going to A, make me happy today and benefit, you know, work towards my future and my tomorrow. So I've been going online a lot more, like Instagram Live. Like, I've been doing that a lot, playing some songs and just connecting, staying connected with fans that way.
That's cool.
You know, me and the guys, the rest of the guys in Plain White Tees are talking about starting to write for a new album or a new EP or something. So maybe we send ideas back and forth and try to do some recordings kind of remotely in pieces, you know, sending right. it to each other. I started a record label last year called Humans Were Here, and I've got a few bands, a few artists signed on that label. And so we have a couple releases that we had recorded before the, you know, everybody was shut down. And so just trying to figure out creative ways to still make a little bit of content and put some stuff out,
right.
You know, because now it's like people are obviously sitting there dying for content. So it's like, it's great that we have some stuff to put out, but yeah, how do we put it out in a way where you can't do a show to promote it, or you can't, you know, film a music video or something, really, you know? So yeah, just trying to be creative, but yeah, you can't really get discouraged. It's like, you got to roll with it. And it's like, right now, this is what it is. So what am I going to do today? And then, you know, 2 months from now, when things start getting, I don't know if it's going to get more normal or more, you know, the new normal, whatever.
Just different. Yeah. Just totally different.
Yeah. But then at that point you reassess and you kind of do what you got to do for right. that moment, you know?
And I wonder too, if some of the new things that you mentioned that you're trying will stick and turn out to be good, pandemic or not, like Instagram Live, for example. Maybe you're going to find that this is the most cost-effective way to connect with fans at any hour from your house. And like, the world opens back up, you can still go on tour, but you decide like, that was a valuable lesson to learn in the pandemic and it's still relevant, you know, now.
Totally. I mean, I've got a weird selfish pipe dream that I can just figure out a way to just make money and do concerts from this couch and, you know, just be with my kid and create music every day and not have to, you know, go on tour.
It's a comfortable looking couch. So
it's a great couch.
It is. Then, with, you know, the pictures in the back, man. I'm like, yeah, relaxed just looking at your pictures, man.
Yeah, this is a good room. I've got a good setup here, especially in this room in particular, that just is like a very peaceful vibe.
You know? It's got a cool vibe for sure. Yeah.
Kind of, yeah, float away a little bit, you know.
So you mentioned that this is a time where people are craving content. So we want to hear from you. Can you give us maybe two bands or artists that you're feeling really passionate to be listening to right now that you're, you know, putting on repeat or feeling excited about that all of us can check out?
Yeah. So, one of my things, I got to do a shameless plug here. I've got, I'm doing a little side project that's an 80s synth pop project called Million Miler.
This is awesome.
And I've put out four songs by Million Miler. And so that, it's always fun to put that on because you need to dance a little bit in the quarantine, you know? You got to get moving. So I would say definitely listen to Million Miler. But then, you know, luckily enough, two of my favorite all-time artists have both released albums. You know, they had them recorded before this, apparently. But The Weeknd put out an album called After Hours that is phenomenal. And The Strokes actually put out an album called The New Abnormal, which was done way before
all this. Oh, that's crazy.
So what a wild...
They're like a bunch of prophets.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, those two albums have definitely been on repeat this whole quarantine. And then, like I said, Million Miler is fun to put on. And just writing, a lot of times I'll just be, not that this, you guys have access to this, but a lot of times I'll do a voice memo and then, like, you know, I'll be making food and I'll push play on that and listen back and see, okay, what can I do to tweak that or change that? So, yeah.
Then, last one is a Plain White Tees song. Is there one that you really love and feel proud of that maybe has not been one of the top hits publicly? That you want to recommend people maybe go back into the archives and check out?
I mean, that's a very tough question because it's like your little babies, you know, it's like every song you write, obviously you have a strong connection to. And it's like, yeah, the, when songs become hits, obviously you're like, oh, I guess that one's my best song. You know what I mean?
Right.
But there's definitely some in there that I think anybody that, you know, most people that are fans of Plain White Tees, know us for those songs like 1, 2, 3, 4, Hater Delilah, Rhythm of Love. So I think in that wheelhouse, we've got a couple songs that may not be as popular, but I think anyone that likes those songs would definitely connect with, we've got a song called Write You a Song, and that's a really beautiful love song. So I would check that one out. Write You a Song. Let Me Take You There is another beautiful one. And we have a song off our very first album called A Lonely September. And all three of those songs are, you know, I think go right up with Delilah and 1, 2, 3, 4 and Rhythm of Love as far as just being great songs and kind of share that same sentiment of just a, you know, a romantic kind of, you know, chill love song.
Yeah. Great. And then, I guess to finish off, there are a lot of people out in the world that love the messages that you give through your music and your platform. Is there anything you want to just share with your fans stuck at home right now for those that end up listening to this?
Well, I mean, you know, I think I've stressed it a little bit already, but just positivity, you know. You know, obviously I'm lucky enough to be in a place where I can relax and I don't have to worry too much. Obviously the financial stuff is rough, but I'm okay right now, you know, and my family and everyone around me is healthy. So that's still, you know, knock on wood on all these things. But I think just keeping a positive attitude is the most important thing. You know, it's like worrying. There was this quote I heard once that was so awesome. And I wish I knew it exactly because I think I mess it up every time. But something about when you worry about something, you have to deal with it twice. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, I'm so worried about this thing. And you worry, you spend this time worrying. And then if it actually happens, then you actually have to deal with it and worry about it a second time. Whereas if you don't worry, half the things you worry about obviously never happen. Most of the things you worry about never happen, you know? So when you're worrying, you're just dealing with things that aren't even real yet. You know?
Is it worrying means you suffer twice?
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, hey, that's pretty
good. I'm Googling. Don't act like I remembered this. Yeah. So yeah, it's quoted for J.K. Rowling. So that's interesting.
Wow. Yeah, wow. Nice.
There it is. Yeah, the power.
Yeah, worrying means you have to suffer twice. That's
nice.
Perfect.
No, that's right. Good. Thanks for sharing that. It's good.
Yeah,
dude, man. Yeah, this was awesome. Yeah, appreciate you taking the time. I love the stories. those are awesome. Yeah, thanks for giving us some insight kind of into everything. Yeah, your start, your creativity, your message to all your fans. Appreciate it. Yeah, thanks, Tom.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
All right. Safe. Yeah, for sure, man. You take care. We'll talk soon.
All right, you guys too. Bye. See ya.
See ya.
This has been Project Rework. Thank you for listening, and for more content, visit us at projectrework.io.